Hello again, Bill DeYoung here. This is Arts Alive, the podcast of the St. Pete Catalyst. Our guest today is Eric Deggans, who is longtime journalist, worked for the Tampa Bay / St. Petersburg Times for many, many years, and is currently the television critic for National Public Radio, among many other things. And he's a national guy, still lives in St. Pete, which I think is cool. Hello.
Hey, yeah, I think that's cool too.
We got lots to talk about. First of all, I remember the first time that I think that we ever talked, I said, you know, NPR TV, I remember when Tom Shales would do these reports on TV. Mm-hmm. He's not still around, is he, Mr. Shales?
No, Tom retired a long time ago, and Tom was a bit of a recluse anyway.
Uh-huh.
We connected kind of on Facebook, but I never actually met him in person. We traded electronic messages.
Funny guy.
Yeah. Well, you know, sometimes cats like that are. He's brilliant, but he was also somebody, you know, like he's from a generation of TV critics, where a lot of them work from home. A lot of them weren't all that concerned with being a part of the regular newsroom.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they had their own thing that they did.
Yeah.
And when you had people who were brilliant, like Tom or Howard Rosenberg at the LA Times, then that was something, you know, that the employers would tolerate. But I think what people also found is that as there was downsizing in the newspaper industry, if you're working from home, you don't have any allies in the newsroom, people don't really know you, it's easier to cut you.
Yeah.
You know? So I kept telling, you know, when I came along, as far as somebody like Shales is concerned, I came along relatively recently. I started covering TV in 1997 after he had already won a Pulitzer by then. But, mm-hmm. You know, I came along and started telling my friends, you know, you really should get into the newsroom. You really should get to know everybody. You really should try to contribute beyond just being somebody who reviews TV shows and talks about what's on TV, because that makes it harder for them to cut you.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, and now that's something I've done just because that's my instinct as a journalist. You know, I started out as a more traditional journalist and then moved into covering music and being a pop music critic, mm-hmm. in New Jersey. And then I came here. I was pop music critic for the St. Petersburg Times for a couple of years, and then moved into television. So I've always felt like, you know, I can help out in any way, and I can do work that addresses a lot of different things. So, you know, and I'm sure we'll talk about this at some point, when Norman Lear died, and news spread that Norman Lear had died yesterday morning. You know, I was willing to go on All Things Considered and talk about him, not just from the standpoint of being a TV critic, but being from the standpoint of somebody who has, you know, watched the evolution of television, knows how the work he did fits into it, and knows how, you know, I mean, he was working on TV projects a week before he died. So this is a guy whose shadow, you know, looms large over television. And I was able to talk about that in a lot of different ways, because I'm not just somebody who, you know, watches television and tells you whether it's good or not.
Yeah. Well, you can do that too. You know, it's interesting that I remember that moment in 70 or 71 or whatever it was, when CBS axed all the rural shows.
Right.
And I remember my mom, with whom I watched television all the time. You know, I was not very old. I was a tot. You
know? No, hopefully.
Anyway, but I remember her saying, I want to watch this thing that's coming on. And that was All in the Family.
Yeah.
Very first episode right there. And there was a sea change in television. So let's talk about Norman Lear.
Sure.
And what he brought to the landscape. I mean, to me, it was ginormous, as they say.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, what's interesting is that Norman was part of a generation of TV producers that rejected this notion that people wanted escapism when they were coming to television. You know, old school TV executives thought, you know, people want to escape their problems when they come to television. They don't want to be reminded of what's happening. And given how bruising the 60s were, you know, I understand that impulse. You know, of course, we had multiple assassinations from JFK to MLK. We had the Vietnam War. We had race riots in major American cities, and all the turbulence around passage of the Civil Rights Act and Voting Rights Act and things like that. So it's a natural impulse to try and make TV like a safe haven where people don't have to deal with that stuff.
Right.
But, you know, these younger producers wanted to talk about these subjects. They wanted to present reality. And so, you know, I interviewed Norman probably in 2016 mm-hmm. for the Smithsonian. We did a public talk based on his memoir and a PBS American Master special that was coming out about him. And so, you know, he revealed that he wanted realism. You know, he based the interior of the set of All in the Family on a real house in Queens. Mm. A lot of Archie Bunker's mannerisms came from his father. His father used to tell his mother to stifle wow. all the time. And he said his father called him the laziest white boy he ever knew. And he said, and he said, why do you have to slander like a whole race of people in order to make me feel bad? and of course, his father didn't see it that way.
How did he sell CBS on this, though?
Well, you know, there was already a successful sitcom in Britain called Till Death Do Us Part.
Yeah.
And it was based on a working class guy who was always clashing with his more liberal son-in-law.
Yeah.
And so, you know... Norman had heard about this show. He hadn't even seen it. But when he heard about it, he realized that a lot of the patterns from his life, and in particular his relationship with his father, was reflected in this show. So mm-hmm. he Americanized it. He created an Americanized version of it and pitched CBS on airing it. And as you said, you know, I think there was a sense that the audience was a little fed up with Petticoat Junction and maybe OFD and all these rural sets.
Green Acres, yeah.
Green Acres, the Andy Griffith Show. Right. And so they were looking for something new, yeah. and he had something new.
Yeah.
And it all, you know, as you know, man, so much of success in show business, in entertainment, is about timing and luck.
Yeah.
And so he had the right idea at the right time and was creative enough to really turn it into something special. And he also gave great credit to Carol O'Connor, who played Archie Bunker. Mm-hmm. He said that he could never have envisioned Archie Bunker the way Carol O'Connor played him. Carol O'Connor was the one who made that character live and really become a three-dimensional character. So mm-hmm. the two of them working together really crafted this amazing character.
And then from there we get Maude. And then we get the Maude. Jeffersons, and this is all out of the sprung like from the
good times,
the head of good times, yeah, from yeah. the head of Zeus, right, from Norman Lear. It all sprang from there.
Well, and I don't know how often this happened before, but one of the things he pioneered was taking a breakout character and then building a show around them.
Yeah.
So Maude was Edith's cousin. And she would come on and kind of give Archie as good as she got from him.
Yeah.
And they realized it was a breakout character, so they built a show around her. She was an older woman, but she was a feminist.
And Maude, sorry about my phone. We do this live. Well, not really live, but you know what I mean.
Live to tape. So she was an older woman. She was a feminist. They spun it. And so the focus of that show was more a feminist in a marriage that was had its challenges, and then all her friends and family, her child, her best friend, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Landmark episode when she got pregnant.
Two-part
episode. Yeah, right, she got pregnant. Her husband... You know, I don't know why she was with this guy, but her husband had promised that he was going to get a vasectomy. He didn't. She got pregnant, and then she decided to end the pregnancy. So Good Times was ostensibly centered on Florida Evans, who was Maude's maid.
I didn't remember that. That's yeah. what I'm on a Maude.
Well, yeah. you didn't remember because in Good Times, they never referred to Maude.
Oh, and my God, fact, John Amos.
What they did was they took
They
took the two characters, John Amos's character and Esther Rolle's character.
Esther Rolle, yeah.
Florida and John and James Evans. And they basically gave them a whole different backstory. So though even though those characters broke out, mm-hmm. they didn't really connect to Maude. They never really referred to Maude. They had some sort of vague references. But, you know, and you know, Maude was set in the East and Good Times was set in a housing project in Chicago. They never even explained how Florida wound up there.
Which is the character sort of sprung from that.
They just took the character and kind of built a whole new story for her. And then, of course, the Jeffersons were black folks who were neighbors to the Bunkers for a while. And
yeah.
they spun them off into their own show.
Well, I think that the caliber of acting, Sherman Hemsley, my God, you know, and what's her name, Bea Arthur. Very strong characters, you know.
Well, I think, you know, I think Norman realized that it was really important to center these shows on strong performers who could create three-dimensional characters. So, mm-hmm. You know, Bea Arthur, of course, was pivotal in being Maude. Norman admired Sherman Hemsley so much, the guy who played George Jefferson,
yeah.
that he essentially delayed bringing that character to All in the Family until Sherman Hemsley finished a run in Pearly, a musical that was on Broadway. And so they had a character that was George's brother, I think, who they used on the show as a foil, as a black foil for Archie. And the way they kind of explained it was that George was so upset at how racist that Archie was, he wouldn't even come into his house. Mm. So his brother was the one who came over there originally.
Oh, I kind of remember this. Yeah, okay.
And kind of tangled with. Well, you know, I interviewed, in addition to doing all the research to interview Norman, of course, I had to do a lot of research to talk about his passing. So so this is all stuff that I kind of remembered. I had remembered that there was a black character on the show who wasn't George Jefferson.
Yeah.
I had forgotten who he was, but he was, he was George's brother. And it was basically because Sherman Hemsley was tied up on Broadway. And then once he was free, then they introduced him to the show, and then he was so popular that they spun off.
It's like Norman Lear and his people sort of knew that Sherman, this was going to happen because he was so charismatic.
Yeah. And I think they had a sense of, you know, when an actor was popping, you know, when an actor was. But that caused some friction, for example, in Good Times when the J.J. character.
Oh, John Amos. I know, hated that whole thing.
Well, not just John Amos. You know, when the show was created, one of the things that Esther Rolle and John Amos kind of insisted on was they wanted an intact black family. They did not want to have a black family where the mom was missing or the dad was missing, because that was what we had seen on TV before. This was the first sitcom to feature an intact black family, and they thought that was really important. And the other thing was they didn't want to have a character on that reminded them of the coonish kind of stereotypical characters that were in TV and film in the 50s and the 60s playing black characters. So when J.J., the character played by Jimmy Walker, started to become more popular, and he had these bug eyes, and he was always, he wasn't too smart book-wise. He was always sleeping around. He was always lazy. He was trying to figure out ways to sort of get around the values of his parents and live this lifestyle that was mostly based on picking up women. Now, let's allow that he was a boy who was graduating high school. There's a lot of boys graduating high school who think that way.
Well, I seem to recall.
And the character was so charismatic that people really liked him. And so they started to focus more of the stories on JJ, which, of course, really upset Esther Rolle and John Amos.
Yeah.
And one of the things that Norman talked about when I interviewed him was that he understood that those actors faced pressure from black viewers when they went out into the world outside of the show.
Yeah.
And people would come to them and say, why are they always talking about JJ? Why is he always so coonish? Why don't you have more stories focused on, you know, the studious youngest son, or, you know, the family together? And you know, of course, Norman always had one eye on the show being appealing and the show getting ratings and the show leaning into what viewers seemed to like about it. And so that, you know, he conflicted a lot with Esther and with John. And John had a way of pushing back that was really disruptive. And so at some point, you know, Norma decided not to renew his contract on the show.
They killed him off, didn't they?
They killed him off. Yeah. They had him die. He had gone down to Mississippi to work a job to make extra money. And on his way back, he was in a car accident. But that was just a way to explain why he died off camera.
That's a tough road to walk, really, between, you know, we got ratings, we're making money.
Yeah.
Our original intention was over here. How do we bring those two together? What I think was so interesting, once, you know, Norman sort of had seeded what was happening in television towards the end of maybe the 70s, that became like the Aaron Spelling era, you know, with really awful escapist. It was almost like the backlash from the Green Acres days. We're going to give always, you moronic stuff here.
Well, there's always a pendulum. There's always a pendulum shift in entertainment because, you know, this is another thing that Norman said that was so perceptive. You know, the chief export of America is excess, is what he said.
Yeah.
And so I think, you know, once people got a sense that realism was catching on with viewers, there was a deluge of sitcoms in particular that were more realistic. And so, of course, it flooded the market.
Yeah.
And in fact, you know, I would argue that, you know, Norman helped create, because he also helped develop Sanford and Son, although he was never, you know, officially credited. That was another British show that was turned into
Steptoe and Son. Right?
Yeah, Steptoe and Son was a British show, and they created Sanford and Son as a vehicle for Red Fox, the black comedian.
Yeah.
So, so the success of Good Times and Sanford and Son created this genre that I like to call the ghetto coms. These were comedies that were set in poor black neighborhoods, featuring mostly black cats.
What's Happening?
What's Happening? There was another one.
They're so memorable, Eric. You just roll right off your tongue here.
I used to have all this stuff top of mind because I used to talk about in this class that I taught about the history of the black image on TV. But there were several. That's My Mama.
Yeah,
was the one I was trying to think of.
Which one had rerun on it?
What's that?
Which one had the character?
What's Happening?
On it. See, that's all I remember.
Of course. Yeah. Well, you know, you're not going to remember every show from this period, but you know, it was a genre, and it could be controversial because on the one hand, there are characters coming to television that we had never seen before, and people are being humanized. You know, people who live in these poor neighborhoods were being humanized in their struggles. Were being brought to a national audience, but they also made areas that were deprived and often dangerous look livable and fun. And they also felt like a different kind of stereotype because when most of the black actors in Hollywood wind up playing these roles, then, you know, and in fact, you know, the story I heard, I didn't get a chance to ask Norman about this, but the story that I heard is that one reason why he created the Jeffersons is because the Black Panthers met with him and they were upset about Good Times. And they were saying, you know, we like the show, but, you know, why is it that every time black people are in a show, they have to be poor or desperate? Why can't we show black people who have means? And so he said, okay. You know, let's take George Jefferson. Let's spin him off. He owns a business. They're going to be moving into a deluxe apartment in the sky.
That's right.
And we'll see what we can do with that. And so, you know, I think ultimately the actual humor in all of those shows didn't turn so much on the environment, which is why it was possible for Sanford and Son and Good Times. What's Happening was, I think. What's Happening, and That's My Mama especially, they were more middle class than they were poor.
Well, the through line here is that we then get the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air and we get Cosby.
Absolutely.
You know, where we have more affluent black people.
Yeah. And again, you know, that could have been a reaction and probably was a reaction to the ghetto cops.
Yeah. You know, your book, Race Baiter, I think came out in 2012.
Yep.
Okay. This is part of what it talks about, how the media perpetuates these things. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. So I think even though people say they understand this, I don't think people really understand how much economics and money making undergird all the decisions that are made in media. And so
I keep telling my kids this, you know.
exactly. So when you see trends or when you see things done, you know, oftentimes it is because somebody thinks that somebody's going to make money or somebody's going to lose money. A good example, this is not in my book because the Marvel Cinematic Universe hadn't really taken flight when the book was published. But, you know, people have criticized Marvel for taking so long to create movies that featured women and featured black people, mm-hmm. non-white people.
Yeah.
Do you know why they took so long?
Because they didn't think they'd make any money.
No, they didn't take. They took so long because there was a creative committee inside of Marvel that featured people who were that was controlled by people who were in charge of toy making, and they were really focused on using Marvel movies as a vehicle to sell toys.
Tie-ins, yeah.
Because they weren't they never
could, wow.
It took them a long time to see that the Marvel movies could be successful movies on their own. They thought they could only really be successful if they produced a groundswell of interest in toys. And they were convinced that toys of women and black people would not sell. I don't know if anyone ever told them about Barbie. I talk a lot in my class about how people will take their prejudices and they will try to wrap them up and some sort of nonsense about business or money making. We also heard, for example, that you know, films starring black people don't do well overseas. But the reason why it seemed that way was because you know, there was that thought in Hollywood. So the only movies that, or the mostly movies that starred you know, black casts,
yeah,
would be about African American culture. So of course those movies are not going to necessarily do well in China or in Europe, where they don't, where they're not familiar with the culture and they may not even be interested in it. But you know, of course you can look at Black Panther the movie and see how well it did overseas, and see that that's, yeah, not true. But I used to tell people the movie After Earth with Will Smith, mm-hmm, you know, and his son. It's this really bad science fiction movie where they get stranded on this, you know, alien planet. It tanked in America,
yeah,
but 60% of its revenue came from overseas.
Hmm.
And the movie made money because of it. So Will Smith is a star, charismatic, you know, compelling, even when he's in a bad movie. And those movies do well overseas. So it's not about the race of the person so much as it is about what story is being told. Is it relatable to people overseas? And do you have a charismatic, talented actor or actress in the lead role? And those people can be black. Those people can be Latino. Those people cannot be white and still be successful. So what I'm constantly doing in the book is talking about how race is connected to these decisions and trying to unravel all of the business financial nonsense that's used to justify decisions, and show how sometimes this is prejudice being justified, you know, by, you know, some patina of, you know, economics. And then sometimes it really is economics. I mean, the reason why, you know, Fox News and that brand of conservatism is such a powerful force in America is because it makes money. You know, Fox News is, you know, the most profitable element of News Corp. You know, it alone pulls in something like $3 or $4 billion a quarter. So this is a
money talks.
Yeah. And so, of course, it spawned a whole alternative network of conservative oriented media platforms, because everyone wants a piece of that money. And even when you look at something like Newsnight, which is this, you know, sort of loose network that we saw, you know, host the most recent GOP debate, you know, their you know, particularly their opinion shows are kind of like Fox News 15 years ago, because they understand that Fox News has gotten, the actual Fox News has gotten too extreme for some viewers. So they're offering a watered down but conservative oriented message that they hope will draw people who are put off by the extremism of some of the hosts who are on Fox News, and particularly the naked racism and sexism.
Yeah.
So, but they're all playing the same game, which is, you know, exacerbating prejudices and stereotypes in order to make money and in order to draw in an audience and keep them from trusting other media outlets and going to other media platforms.
I just don't know how you can not be a cynic. I mean, going into like, I'm suspicious of everything behind every, that everybody in, connected with television does.
Sure.
That there's usually, as you say, a marketing reason for it.
Right. It's my money-making reason. Well, I mean, you know, people say that they're cynical, but the point of fact is, they want to believe. I mean, that's the reason why these messages work, is that people want to believe them. There are a lot of white people who want to believe that they're just as oppressed as non-white people. They want to believe it. So when Fox News comes along and says, you know, systemic racism doesn't exist, that, you know, people want unfair advantage, that incidents of racism are isolated and sporadic and are the result of specific bad people doing bad things, there's a bunch of people out there who want to believe that.
Yeah.
And they want to justify why their life hasn't worked out the way they wanted it to, by saying, well, you know, there's a bias against me out there. It's hard for people to admit when they have a systemic advantage.
It's salve, and it's Petticoat Junction for 2023. You know,
in a way. I mean, you know, it's hard for me to admit as a man the systemic advantages that I have, but I know I have them.
Yeah.
I've seen it at work, And so you have to willfully turn a blind eye to so much in order to deny how systemic racism and sexism and marginalization advantages some groups over others in Western society and in American society in particular. And, you know, ultimately, I think the reason why we should get rid of this stuff is not just because we want to be fair to everybody, not just because it's the altruistic thing to do, but because everybody does better. You know,
yeah.
TV gets better when our most creative minds are empowered to tell their stories, whoever they are. I once interviewed Margot Lee Shetterly, the woman who wrote Hidden Figures, the book on which the movie is based. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's a book and movie about, you know, this group of black women who weren't officially allowed to be part of NASA's space program, but they were used as sort of human calculators to help figure out the complex equations that were needed to be solved in order to send someone to the moon.
Right.
And in the book, the author has just a tiny section where she talks about how one reason why the Soviet space program may have pulled ahead of the American space program in the 1950s and early 60s was because they allowed women to be part of their engineering teams in a way that the Americans did not. So it was much more likely that they had their sharpest, smartest mathematical minds working on solving the problems of space travel because they weren't excluding them over something stupid as their gender. And so, you know, that's the proof that if we actually make ourselves a free and fair society and get rid of systemic racism, we'll have our best minds on the forefront of every problem. If we didn't have to deal with these sort of nonsense political fights about COVID, about fossil fuels, you know, about hunger and housing the poor, about racism, we would be so much further along in solving these problems if we could get rid of the nonsensical political and economic appeals that are made to different people's egos in order to monetize their attention. And you know, this is all obvious stuff. This is all, you know, I'm not saying anything that 1,000 people haven't said before me, but it is frightening and discouraging to see how much people will disregard what they say they stand for in order to support someone who they think represents their interests.
We have just a couple of minutes left. I'm going to totally shift gears here.
Sure.
And say, yeah, see, there it goes. That I understand you're a pretty damn good drummer.
I like to think I am. I've been playing for 40 years, so hopefully I learned.
Paul Wilburn was just saying, "Oh, Eric, yeah, man, he's a great musician." You know, was that what you were gonna be? You're from Indiana, I think. Is that correct?
I'm from Gary, Indiana, home of Michael Jackson.
There you go.
No, when I was freshman in high school, in eighth grade, so kind of in that area, I thought to myself, you know, I felt that I had to be focused in high school and college in order to get to where I wanted to go. My mother was amazing. She was a school teacher. She had scrimped and saved to send me to a private middle school, and she was sending me to a private high school. And I knew that I had to succeed in order to justify the sacrifices she was making, mm-hmm. and in order to get out of the neighborhood that we were in, which was a pretty tough one. So I said, okay, I'm good at writing. I'm good at playing music. I was also artistic. I could draw, but I wasn't nearly as good at that as I was at the other two things. So I thought, how could I put these two things together in a job that would earn me a steady paycheck? And I decided I was going to try and be a pop music critic sort of at the highest level. So from high school all the way through college, I dedicated myself to pursuing those two things, to trying to be a great musician, but also trying to be a great journalist, thinking that I could use my insights as a musician to be a pop music critic, and that that would, you know, ultimately result in a job at a place like the New York Times or maybe, you know, Musician Magazine existed back then,
yeah.
Or Rolling Stone.
You know, it is true, too, because I started as a pop music writer, and I think that, you know, I'm actually a pretty bad guitar player, but I've been doing it like 40, 50 years or something like that. But I think it is true, wouldn't you say, that being a musician helps you to talk to musicians. There's just some kind of vibe that happens.
Absolutely.
You can take shortcuts in the way that you interpret each other.
Well, you understand what it's like to try and create something. You understand what it's like. I mean, if you've done it at a certain level. I mean, when I was in college, I formed a band called the Voyage Band, and we got signed to Motown. We put together a single for a charity record, and it became this surprise hit throughout Indiana, Illinois, Ohio, Kentucky. We toured through all those places. We wound up getting signed to Motown, and we got a bunch of money, and we went up to Chicago to record an album. So, you know, when I'm talking to musicians, I know what it's like to create a ground-level single. I know what it's like to get signed by a major label. I know what it's like to get signed by a major label that doesn't care about you and that eventually you get dropped from.
That's an old story. It's an old story.
I know all of it. I know what it's like to be in the studio when the red light goes on and you got to produce, right?
Yeah.
And I've continued playing and recording with people, you know, the whole time I've been a journalist. So I understand a lot about it. So when I'm around musicians, you know, when I became a pop music critic, I was working for a newspaper in New Jersey. I was working for the Asbury Park Press.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of musicians who live in that area who are pretty big. John Bon Jovi's there. Mm-hmm. Bruce Springsteen's there.
Yeah.
Smithereens were there. You know, John and I connected early on through his mother, who runs his fan club, and he was really interested in sort of cultivating the allegiance of the local pop music critics. So I got a lot of access to him. Bruce Springsteen was a different thing, but when he formed a band, after he kind of disbanded the E Street Band and he formed a band to do two albums, Human Touch and Lucky Town, the woman that he recruited...
We don't talk about those records.
Well, the woman that he recruited to play keyboards and sax and sing and percussion, Crystal Talaferro, is an old friend of mine. We grew up together in Gary, and we played together when we were at Indiana University together.
Cool.
So I was able to tell Bruce, hey, you know, I know Crystal, you know, if you ever want to talk to the paper, we would love to talk to you. And then he started working with Joe Grushecki, who is this rock artist from Pittsburgh. I had worked, I was friends with everybody in his band. I would work with some of those guys. So once he knew that I was friends with people that he knew and trusted, he wound up talking to me and giving me the first exclusive interview with the newspaper that it had had with Springsteen in 20 years.
There you go.
So that's what you can get when you know what it's like to be a musician, when you have friends who are doing... I mean, I have friends... I have a friend from IU right now who's playing with Bon Jovi.
For me, I was living in Gainesville, and it was Tom Petty and the
Heartbreakers. Yeah, of course, of course.
Because we had a lot of mutual friends, and that sort of friendship developed there.
So I got to know Stan Lynch, too.
Stan's a great dude.
Wonderful
guy. In fact, I need to call him. Thanks for reminding me.
Yeah.
You came here in 95, I think. Why Florida?
Because the
job was open?
Because the St. Petersburg Times was hiring a pop music
critic. The job was open. Okay.
But it wasn't just that. Like, I knew that the St. Petersburg Times was what they call a writer's paper.
Yeah.
It was a paper where it would let even run-of-the-mill reporters really take chances in their writing if it was compelling.
Yeah.
And you know, there were some places, you know, the New York Times in particular, back then especially, that they, once you joined, they expected you to write like everybody else there.
Mm-hmm.
And then there were other papers that would let you express yourself as a writer. So I knew that if I came to the St. Petersburg Times, they would nurture me as a writer. I would be allowed to express myself in ways that I could already feel was different than the way other people chose to write about things.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a paper that had already won several Pulitzer Prizes. I think it was on its way to being the most read paper in the state. I don't think it was there when I came, but it got there pretty soon after, I'm pretty sure.
Within 2 years, you kind of became the TV guy.
Right, right.
What brought that on?
Man, well, I'm going to tell you the long story, and you can cut it if you need to. But part of it was I was covering the New Music Seminar, and I don't know if you remember the New Music Seminar from your days as a pop music critic, but it was this big convention that brought the whole music industry to New York.
Yeah, they never sent me there. That's what I remember. Well, I
got to go a few times, and basically, once you register for the convention, your admissions badge would get you into clubs all over Manhattan. So I was able to go to the Bitter End and the Knitting Factory and CBGB's, all these legendary places that I'd heard about, but I'd never actually been to, and I could watch, you know, showcase performances. So Marilyn Manson was playing a showcase performance for Nothing Records, Trent Reznor's label, at a club, and I went. And Maryland kind of had some weird tie to Florida, right? They played in Florida for a while.
Yeah.
I think they played in South Florida.
Used to go to Asylum Records up on Central, and there was always Maryland stuff all over the place. Signed, you know. Yeah.
I think they might have gotten signed out of Florida even, but I know that they had kind of played in South Florida. So there were a lot of people from Florida's music scene there. So I went.
Yeah.
And I'm watching Maryland play, and there's a point in the music where the guitar player and the bass player and Marilyn all throw whatever they have in their hands at the drummer. The guitars hit the side of the drum kit, but Marilyn must have been excited. So the mic stand with this big heavy bass on it sailed right over the top of the drum kit, hit Ginger Fish in the face, the drummer, and knocked him out. And of course, because half of their show is computers, it's sequenced. Mm-hmm. The song kept playing, and the band was looking at each other like, what are we going to do now? And so then everything stops, house lights come up, they call an ambulance that comes and takes Ginger Fish away.
Oh, my God.
Moby was there, and he hates Marilyn. He hates Brian. And so he was trying to convince the journalist there to write that the police should arrest Brian for attempted murder. For what happened to Ginger. And so, you know, I run out to a payphone and I sort of call in the story to the Times. That was back in the day. And then I come back to the bar where all these people from the Florida scene are hanging out. And I just thought to myself, okay, who in this group is married and has kids? And I was the only person. Mm. And I was like, you know what? I am too old for this.
Oh, that light bulb moment. I know that moment. Yeah.
And and you know, it was also getting to be the era of Britney Spears and NSYNC and Backstreet Boys, and I didn't understand.
Well, I want to go do something else. Crap. Yeah.
I didn't understand why people like that crap. And then, you know, I actually met Lou Pearlman and hung out with him in Orlando, and I could tell there was something sleazy about that
dude.
Oh,
yeah,
And so I also sort of felt like there was this whole underbelly to the boy band and the girl idol thing that I did not want to spend my time writing about, and I didn't want to write about that crap if I wasn't digging into the truth of what was happening.
I hear you.
So all of that made me decide, you know, I think for the most part, there are some people who are really great at covering pop music as they get older, but I think for the most part, it's a younger person's game, and I just felt like my time was over. So,
are you sure we're not twins from a different mother or something? I don't know, man.
Well, the thing is, like, okay, the TV critic who used to work for the San Francisco Chronicle, Tim Goodman, good friend of mine, he was a pop music critic, had the same revelation. Neil Justin, the guy who covers TV for the Minneapolis paper, same thing.
Wow.
Roger Catlin, I don't know if you knew Roger. He was actually somebody who was a real inspiration to me. Real great music critic for the Hartford Courant, who also did the same thing. He writes about TV now. He made the transition to television. A lot of us sort of got to the point where we're like, you know, pop music is not something that we want to spend our energy on, but if we write about television, it's a broad platform to write about anything, you know, gender, politics, religion, race, there's something, there's a documentary, there's a scripted show, there's a news report that's touching on those subjects. So when you write about television, if you have an expansive and open mind, you can write about anything. And so Monica Yant, people may remember her. She's also wonderful. She was an amazing TV critic at the St. Pete Times, and she got a job at the Philadelphia Inquirer, and so I pitched myself to be the new TV critic, and, you know, they moved me over.
You've been at NPR for 10 years now.
Yep.
I see you on CNN. I see it everywhere. You know, how often are you on NPR? You have a studio in your house, I imagine.
Well, not a studio per se. Nothing as glamorous and glorious as where we're all here.
Oh, please. But, oh, please.
Now, basically, in my home office, I have a digital recorder and I have a shotgun mic set up.
Yeah.
I have a laptop and I have software that allows me to edit sound so that I can pull clips from TV shows that I'm watching or pull clips from, you know, even from interviews. I pulled a clip from an interview with Norman Lear and, and had that made available for when we talked about his passing. Yep. So I can edit and assemble things, but it's not a studio per se. My home office isn't soundproofed or anything. I just have a really good mic and I have a really good digital recorder. And, you know, it sounds wonderful. And I also have a device we call a Comrex that allows me to connect in live action to any studio in that NPR uses.
That's what I was going to say. If you're going to talk to the host and all things considered
in real time,
In real time, then you can do that from your home too.
Absolutely. And we also have a wonderful app that we encourage the people that we're interviewing to download so that they can use their smartphone and it'll sound just like they're in a studio, just like we're in a studio. And sometimes I used to use that during COVID I got the equipment to, you know, have this direct connection. And then, you know, I have a similar setup. I have an office at the Poynter Institute and I have a similar setup there.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the technology has advanced to the point where you don't really need a lot of gear to be able to create really great radio.
Eric Deggans is TV critic and media analyst for National Public Radio. He is also an author and a speaker. I watched your TED talk the other day.
TEDx.
TEDx. We don't say X around my house.
I know. That's how upset everybody is with Elon.
Anyway, Eric, thanks so much for being here today. We're glad that you've decided to stay in St. Petersburg. Because it's nice to know that, you know, I just call you up and you come down and do this for us.
It's a beautiful place, man. And one thing I'm trying to do after COVID is reconnect with the community more. So, you know, I'm serving on the board of Creative Pinellas. I've been guest hosting Florida this week on WEDU for Rob Lori. You know, anytime you need me, man, just call. I'd be happy to come out. I really love this place. And just like, you know, like I stay on X, even though Elon Musk is turning it into a hell site. I don't want to give up places that I love just because there's a jerk that bought the place or there's a jerk that's in the governor's mansion or whatever. You know, I this place is wonderful. It's really special. And I'm going to do everything I can to support the community.
Well, as I always say when we end the show, whenever somebody says something like that, I say, you know, from your mouth to God's ear. So listen, Eric, thanks very much for being here.
Hey, thank you, man. I really enjoy your work, too. And I'm honored that you asked me to be here.